Thank you. I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for the invitation to come and for all of you to coming back from lunch and populating this. All right, so I'm going to talk about contaminants of both soil and water. I'm going to focus a little bit more on water than I am on soil, but I'll get into that. And one of the perspectives that we have to think about is both within the developed and within the developing world, where we're getting our water from. And with both changes in our lifestyles, along with increasing populations, we're really pushing our water resources quite hard. And that's going to only change as we go into the future. I always get a little distracted here at the end, so I want to make sure that I acknowledge the people that have done a lot of the work. So I'm going to particularly talk about some work that two students, Deborah Hausladen and Sarah Fockerdeen, have done with me. And then there's others that have contributed to that. So I'll come back to that at the very end if we have time. So the point that I was making is that we're increasingly stressing our water resources, and that's really pushing us more and more to move towards groundwater. So at Stanford, I'm obviously in California, and in the western U.S. in general, but in California specifically, we've had a really interesting last 5 years. So 4 of those years have been extreme drought. And that has really changed people's mentality about thinking about the sustainability of water and where we're going to get it. So the classic view was we would think about getting it from surface reservoirs with a combination of groundwater. And increasingly now, though, we're starting to think about how we get to groundwater because of our surface water, both limitations and vulnerabilities. All right. So when we switch to groundwater, though, we have a bunch of new things that we have to start thinking about. And this is where soils really come in. And so it's not always obvious to people that think about groundwater that the first thing you have to think about is where that water is coming from, and where it comes from is through the soils. Right? At one point in time, that water percolated down through the soil. It may have moved in laterally, but a lot of it is recharging through the soil. And so we have to think about how the soil then is impacting water quality. Okay, so if you think about groundwater, in the U.S. in particular, but this is true on a global basis, there are a number of classic risks that we think of that set us up to having vulnerable groundwater. One of the big ones is nitrate, right? So this is typically, not exclusively, but largely from agriculture, so both from fertilization, animal lot, feedlots, and so on. It can also be from industrial sources as well, but nitrate in general is usually we think of it as a big vulnerability to groundwater arising from agricultural inputs. On the other side are things that are coming both from industry and from more urban centers, and these are usually the metal pollutants. And so the metal pollutants arise from all kind of different activities. They can be from mining, they can be from recycling plants, nuclear energy production, and so on. And there's a host of different metals that we start thinking about. So this is EPA's top list here of metals that we think about contaminating soils. And so arsenic is a big one that I study, so it's highlighted in red, both because it's number one and because I like to study it. So, but then there's a bunch of other ones, chromium, lead, zinc, nickel, cadmium, and we could keep going on that list. But those are just giving you a few of the things that we start thinking about. All of those, though, in this list here are from some type of anthropogenic activity, right? Chromium to me is a really good example of this, and I'm using it because I want to come back to it later on. So chromium is something that's used in a lot of different industrial processes, anywhere from leather tanning to chrome plating to metallurgy. And if you look in California at where the hot spots of groundwater contamination here, which are what you're seeing here in terms of the vertical bars, that's the concentration of chromium in groundwater. And you see that there are a number of really, really high levels. Those tend to be around some type of industrial complex. So the big one in the bottom there is the LA complex, right? So Los Angeles area. And then we have the Bay Area up and then above that up in Redding. So that's a little anomaly, but nevertheless, mostly we think about this as industrial contamination. That is a New Jersey plume right there coming out of a plating and metallurgy area. That's all chromium-6. That's percolating into the groundwater. And so you might expect that you have fairly significant contamination resulting from that. All right, now, if you looked at my title at all, I said something about naturally occurring, and those are not naturally occurring. So I want to pivot here and go from talking about contaminants that we would generally think of and change our mindset a little bit and think about ones that are naturally occurring, or geogenic, as we like to call them, and how those impact water and what we should be thinking about in terms of their impacts. And so there's a number of different metals, a whole host, right? We go across the periodic table, but some of the really big ones that we think about are things like arsenic, cadmium still up here, chromium, manganese, uranium. Those are some really big ones that you should be thinking about if you're tapping into groundwater. Now, tomorrow I'm giving another talk that's not too dissimilar to this one. I kind of think of it as part two. And one thing I'm not going to talk about on this one, but I'll talk about tomorrow, is what's missing on that list. And one of the really big ones, particularly if you're in the U.S., and you look up this list, there's one that should jump out at you that's missing. Anybody want to guess? What do I not have on there that you should think of? Lead, right. So everybody in the U.S. should be thinking about lead because it's been in the news so much, right? And yet it's not on my list. And it's not because I forgot, even though I was, you know, putting this together typically way ahead of time. But I consciously left lead off there. And not because I want to talk about it tomorrow, but because it's not a threat to groundwater. And I'm going to leave it at that. We can talk about it later. But it's a big concern for drinking water. It's not a concern for groundwater. If you tap groundwater, you still might have to worry about lead, but it's not because of the groundwater itself. Okay, so let's go on and talk about these naturally occurring contaminants and how they threaten water systems. All right, so first one is that there are a number of different ways we can go about doing this, and you can find nice global threat maps for a lot of these different elements. So one of the ones that's often not on our radar, that if you work for the World Health Organization, you will think about, and that's fluoride, right? So fluoride can actually, we need a little bit of it, but we don't want too much of it. And so it actually is one of the major concerns that we have when we switch from surface water to groundwater. And so we can look at threat maps. We can do the same thing for arsenic. So global threat map for arsenic. There's been some really good work. I know a number of people here are from China as well, so some really good maps for China now in terms of where the big threats are. These are threats. So what are those threats based on? So, or risk is another way we say that, right? So I'm going to go into that next, and I want to do that by also comparing when we think about industrial or urbanized contamination against geogenic. And really what I would say on this is its magnitude, like the concentration levels versus the distribution of those toxins. And so this is, I think, a good example for us to go back to. So I showed you chromium earlier, and you can see these big hot spots here that are now on the upper left panel. This is my little California battleship here, aircraft carrier. It looks like a model aircraft carrier to me for some reason. But anyways, that gray color, I guess. So you can see there that there's these really acute hot spots that arise from industrial contamination. It turns out, though, that if you actually remove those, the majority of California's groundwater that's tainted with chromium, which is actually quite extensive, I might add, is largely in the Central Valley of California, where you're devoid of these industrial inputs. And they're not wood processing. There's no other inputs in there. And it turns out that those are geogenic sources. The chromium is actually part of the coastal range and a little bit of the Sierra Mountains, but particularly the coastal range. It's a natural occurring element, fairly benign. It's in the chromium 3 form, fairly low solubility, but it is present there. And the alluvial sediments that come down and fill the Central Valley Basin are subject to getting oxidized. And it turns out that that's a fairly complicated pathway and something that we have to spend another talk on, but it's occurring. And it's generating chromium 6. And that happens completely removed from any type of anthropogenic alteration. And then there's things that we do to accentuate that. I'm not going to go into that. I just want to point out the difference between industrial source to geogenic. The geogenic is really the large distributed contaminant, and the industrial is that acute localized area. And the same generally goes for mine waste. Can go across the board. That's not always true, but in general, you're talking about really devastating impacts on a very, very small region, whereas the naturally occurring contaminants can have really big impacts over a very, very, very large region, and we have to be mindful of that then. Okay, so what is this really risk like? What causes things like chromium or other elements to get into the water. And this is something I think we as soil scientists recognize, but we need to articulate to people that are thinking about water, and particularly groundwater. And that is that if we think about soils, most of us should be thinking about a large fraction of the solids that then have this pore space that's going in there. And that's true whether we're at the surface and the near surface, so we're really in soils, or we're moving down into the sediments. And what that does is that completely changes then, if you think about it, the surface area to water volume ratio. So if you look at surface reservoirs, right? So up at the top here, you have a lake, you're getting your water from that. If you have a lead-lined lake, you still have a very, very small surface area to volume ratio. And so unless that lake lining is incredibly soluble, you're going to dilute it out and not going to end up finding too much within the water column, by and large. Take now a speck of lead and put it down into to the ground, as in the soil or sediment, and get a transfer mechanism where you can take that lead and move it into the water. If you do a lot of those transfers, that entire aquifer becomes contaminated. And that's what we have to be mindful of, is that surface area to volume ratio for groundwater is really different from surface water, and that's why soil science becomes so important for this. Okay, so this is really then when we think about the threats to the groundwater, what we're really talking about is one, yes, you have to have the element or the contaminant present, something like, let's use lead or chromium or arsenic, but that's not enough. It's not just that there's a lot there. In fact, I would really, really argue stringently, you don't want to look at total concentrations. You just want to see presence or absence. And then after that, you need to switch and think about how is it partitioned. And that then leads to what are the reactions that dictate whether that contaminant, if you want to think of it that way, that element is going to be on the solids or in the water, and what that ratio is going to be. And the big threats tend to be two main transitions. One are different redox conditions, right? So a change in redox conditions. And that's, by and large, what happens with arsenic, right? We sit in the surface environments, well aerated, arsenic partitions well onto the solids. We go to an anaerobic environment. We start to dissolve the iron oxides, change the oxidation state of arsenic, and all of a sudden we find it partitioning in the water. It's not that the arsenic all of a sudden magically appeared. It magically appears in the water. That's the difference. Okay, the other big thing besides redox transitions are pH extremes. And so this one, the redox is actually a more subtle change. The pH are ones where we get really acidic or really alkaline, typically is where we're going to drive problems. And then there's more nuanced things that I just wanted, for completion, I want to think of chelating agents, right? We should be thinking about those, or competing ions that might displace. Those can be important. They tend not to be as largely influential. So if we think about some of the ones I put up here earlier, chromium and uranium on the top box, those are oxidatively mobilized. So you take sediments that have been deposited under anaerobic conditions and you subject to an oxidation event, and now you get chromium-6 or you get uranium-6. Uranium and chromium-6 both tend to be more soluble than their more reduced counterparts, and in the case of chromium, becomes toxic. All right, arsenic is the reverse, right? So arsenic, we know that when we're in an oxidized environment, tends to pose little hazard unless we're at really extreme pHs. It's that reduction event going to anaerobic conditions that causes arsenic to be problematic. All right, I'm going to focus on that for just a few slides. Anybody who knows me at all probably figures somewhere in here he's got to talk about arsenic, and he's got to talk about arsenic in Asia because I've done a lot of work over there. And you're right, I have to do that, so I'm going to. But just for a little bit, and a little differently than I usually do. So I usually talk about the Ganges, Brahmaputra River, and then the Mekong River and the Red River. And instead, what I want to do is I want to talk about the Indus River and the Ganges River and the Brahmaputra River. And that's really what we call the Indo-Gangetic Plain. So that is four main countries, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and Nepal. About 1 billion people living across this plain and heavily rely on groundwater for both domestic purposes and for agriculture. And it turns out that's a really, really fascinating case study on groundwater recharge, and it's something that California right now needs to be looking at. So it turns out when the British colonized India, one of the things they did is they put in a massive network of canals to distribute the surface water around for agricultural purposes. those canals were unlined. And it turns out that unlined canals do what? They leak, right? They leak like a sieve, which turns out to be terrible if you're looking at surface water and the efficiency of this canal system. But it turns out when they leak, what are they doing? And why does California care about that? Turns out they're recharging the groundwater. So the groundwater in this basin, despite being arid in many areas and having massive extraction, is actually being replenished and not dropping. So it's a great, great story of groundwater recharge and complete success for redistributing that water through the ground, right? It's really excellent. So California needs to take all their liners out and let that water start percolating through. Okay. But here's the catch. Next graph. Those red spots and the hatched marks represent contamination. The hatched marks are high arsenic, and the scaling colors, the orange to red, that's high salt. Turns out 55% of that groundwater is compromised by either salt or arsenic, 28% by arsenic, right? High arsenic. So you can still put it on an agricultural crop, but you've got to be very careful about thinking about doing that, because depending on what you're growing, you might be taking it up. If you're growing rice, you really, really don't want to be doing that. What do you think the major crop they grow in this region? Yeah, rice. If it was wheat, corn, not so much. It wouldn't be such a big deal, but rice, big, big problem. Domestic purposes, also huge problem. All right, so that's the problem. Now, how did that happen? Well, we know how that happened. By and large, there's a few places in Pakistan in particular where it's high pH, but by and large, most of this is because you had arsenic up in the Himalayas, and it must have been massive amounts, right? Yeah, it turns out it's not. Not that much. But you had some arsenic up in the Himalayas. It washes down in the big river systems. It deposits out in these floodplains. Again, not high amounts, 20 milligrams per kilogram, below the sedimentary average for global sedimentary basins. But it's there. Okay, so, and then what happens is now it's partitioned. The arsenic is partitioned onto the iron oxides at the point of deposition. Not a big problem. You could grow wheat or corn in there, no big deal. You could extract water over that upper meter if you could actually get it out, and you wouldn't have much of a problem. But we know that what happens is that when we go down in the soil profile, particularly with a high water table like this, the conditions switch, we go anaerobic, and now we have a problem where we have organic carbon being used by bacteria, driven to CO2 partially, while they're reducing the iron oxides that the arsenic is sitting on and changing the oxidation state of arsenic, and now we have arsenic 3 in groundwater, and that's our problem. And from here, it percolates down into the aquifers below, and we have this massive contamination problem. Okay, great. So we know that how we fix it is more challenging, and by and large, you're not. So you're going to have to filter it back out. Different ways we can talk about how you could do that. Bigger problem is really when you're using it for irrigation and you're trying to grow rice. And that, to me, is really, really the big, big issue on the block right now. Okay, those are all things we know. What I want to do is a wrap-up for make anybody nervous. So I'm going to start my second half of the talk now. No, I'm just joking. Last little part, and then I'll wrap up. Always got to put something like that in there. Michael's over here going, oh, crap. No, okay, so the last thing I just want to point out is that what I told you were things that are actually fairly obvious. I think maybe not things we always thought of, but once you do, pretty obvious. And what I wanted to do is point out that there are sometimes triggers that are not so obvious, or at least not so obvious to me. Now, maybe to others, but... And one of those happens to be an example that happens in Southern California, Orange County, where we've been working. And this is what I'm going to call non-oxidative release of low arsenic constant. So low arsenic in the solids. So let me just do this briefly. Okay, so it turns out that Orange County Water District has a really, really great strategy. They take all of their sewage effluent, they do what's called advanced processing, and they basically make it to distilled water. So it's just pure water. But at least in the U.S., people get really squeamish of this water, and they call it toilet to tap. And everybody goes, no, I can't drink it, because that water molecule has sometime been in contact with human feces. even though it's still just a water molecule, right? That doesn't work. So the deal that Orange County made with the populace was that they would take this water, treat it to this advanced standard, and then put it back in the ground. And it would sit in the ground for a period of time, 6 months minimum, it turns out. So that's what they do. They take it and they mostly use what are called infiltration ponds. So I'm going to step away from the mic just real quickly. So what they do is the water comes into these ponds. These actually these beautiful blue ponds. They should have them more ubiquitously in LA because they're actually really beautiful, like this oasis in this urban desert, right? And so that water then percolates down through the strata and recharges an unconfined aquifer, and that's what they're using then to pump back out 6 months later. Okay, now here's the catch. You look at this, and there's a few little lenses that you go down here that have arsenic in it. Uh-oh, arsenic, right? But look at the concentrations that are over here. Right? So 0.6, 2.9, 1.2, 1.2, 0.67 milligrams of arsenic per kilogram. That's small. You tell me that's an aerated aquifer, pH less than 8, and you're less than 3 milligrams per kilogram of arsenic, and there are little lenses in there, could you ever have a problem? Absolutely not. No way. Right? It just would geochemically can say no. You don't even have to monitor it. But fortunately, they did. And here's what you find is that this is a little interesting, and so let me walk you through it super quickly. So they use chloride as an inverse tracer. When their water is percolating in through that pond, it doesn't have any chloride in it. When the natural recharge comes, it has chloride in it. So when chloride goes down, that tells us their water is coming in. So here comes chloride going down. What's going up? Look over here. It should be red instead of blue, but it's blue. What is it? Arsenic. When their water comes in, arsenic comes off those sediments, even though it's really low, and gets into the water. When their water goes away, so here's their water going away. Their water goes away, the arsenic goes down, right? Displaced. What in the world's going on there? So here's the part that we didn't expect. It's okay, I'm almost done. I think I have 2 slides left. It turns out that the arsenic is bound to phyllosilicate clays through a calcium and magnesium bridge. Divalent cation, populated charge reversal, you now get an anion binding to it. And that turns out to be really easy to destabilize. And their water's percolating in. What doesn't it have in it? Doesn't have any calcium or magnesium in it. No chloride, no calcium, no magnesium. And so this re-equilibrates very quickly with their water. And that arsenic comes off, contaminates their water. And now you have tens of millions of people with contaminated drinking water. That's a big deal. Right? It turns out the solution, though, is super easy. What's the solution? What do you tell them? What did you tell Orange County Water District? You need to do what to your water? You need to not put it in the... No, I was just telling them, don't put it in the ground, but they have to. So they just add calcium and magnesium back to the water as it's percolating in, problem goes away. So guess what they're doing? They're adding calcium and magnesium. So we actually have a role, right? So soil scientists can come in and help this. All right. And it turns out, this is just a cartoon of what was happening. That's the story, is that this is not something I ever would have predicted. We know it from soil chemistry, but it's not something I would have anticipated to be demonstratively affecting groundwater, and yet it is. And so I'll stop there and just say the few takeaways is that things I already said, anthropogenic contamination tends to give us really high concentrations in a very localized environment. Geogenic contamination tends to give us lower concentrations but distributed over large areas. And it's that surface area to volume ratio of the groundwater that really becomes important. And that then leads us to something that I can't emphasize this enough, is it's not the total concentrations that matter. It only matters that the contaminant is there, and then it matters whether there's a trigger that causes it to destabilize and go into the water. And we need to be thinking about redox and pH, and then occasionally we have to be thinking about some of these things that we might not have predicted. And those are going to start cropping up, I think, more and more as we start managing our groundwaters more extensively. And so with that, I'll stop. Thanks.
Take time for one question. Anyone have a question? Thank you for the talk, Scott. Regarding the arsenic absorption through cotton breeding, do we know how much in terms of percentage? If we know the total,
yeah.
What's the percentage?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a great question. It turns out it's not a lot. It's about 20% of the total arsenic is actually in that complex. No.